I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Thanks for listening and being part of my podcast. I hope 2024 is kind to you. In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts with a mixture of interesting and thought-provoking guests discussing the human side and impact of crime on all those involved, including the investigators. And I'd love for you to give me a review if you can. They're just a great help to me. I give my guests the opportunity to tell their story in their own words and how they remember an incident. It may not be how others remember it, which I ask you to please keep in mind. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, contact Lifeline or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. Thank you.
There's this link between somebody's demeanour and assumptions about somebody's credibility or guilt because we have such a strong image of what a woman should look like and how a woman should act, even though that image doesn't necessarily line up with what we know from psychology is natural and is within the range of natural responses that somebody might have to a traumatic event.
Today is week two of a three-part series of my interview with Dr. Leah Williams, a lecturer in criminology and criminal law at the University of New South Wales. So just to bring you up to speed, last week I introduced you to Dr. Williams. I said how I'd come across an article in The Guardian by a woman named Donna Liu. It was published in May of 2023 and it was titled, quote, Kathleen Folbig, Science Sheds New Light on Case of Mother Convicted of Murdering Her Children, unquote. And the article caught my eye, as did an opinion in that article by Dr. Williams, where she stated, quote, there's an entrenched traditional notion of what femininity is that I think can disadvantage women who come into contact with the criminal justice process. It's something that you really saw with the Lindy Chamberlain case. She didn't cry enough, or she didn't seem sad enough. All the judgments made about character then feed into perceptions of criminal guilt, unquote. And Dr. Williams says that Kathleen Folbig was similarly demonised. So who is Dr. Williams? She's a lecturer in the School of Law, Society and Criminology in the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales. She teaches criminal law courses across the law and criminology programs and has an interest in legal education, criminalisation and the representation of crime and criminal justice processes in the media. Her doctoral research examined the ways in which gender norms are reinforced and amplified through the reporting of criminal trials and the relationship between those gender norms and notions of deviance. Her research is inspired by a fascination with the way in which criminal law and criminal justice processes are communicated to and understood by the public and the differences in social and legal definitions of justice. So if you haven't listened to last week, I think you should, but last week we discussed how social media has made a huge impact in our lives, in particular reporting news and newsworthy events almost instantaneously, which embraces open justice, and how sometimes that reporting can be inaccurate and prejudicial, affecting procedural fairness for both the accused and the victim or survivor. Dr. Williams shared with us some of her findings regarding, for instance, apprehended bias of potential jurors, contamination of witnesses, and the frustration of suppression orders. And I'm just thinking, just in the last week or so, we've had yet another suppression order here in Victoria in relation to the Samantha Murphy investigation. And Dr. Williams talks about the fact that Victoria have a very, very large representation within the Australian states of suppression orders. So this week we talk more about the Kathleen Folbig case and why people become so entrenched in stories like hers and, say, Lindy Chamberlain. Dr. Williams spoke of the fact that people have an emotional reaction to cases, particularly about a mother accused of murdering a child of her own, or in Kathleen Folbig's case, three of her children and the manslaughter of her fourth child. We discuss the way that these women were represented in the media and how their behaviour was contrasted against what we might call ideal femininity, as, you know, like being subordinate, nurturing, maternal and calm, etc. I might just add here that Kathleen Folbig has been pardoned for all the cases that she went to trial over and actually spent time, 20 years or so, in jail for. So, continuing on, so these two women, Kathleen Folbig and Lindy Chamberlain, these two women in particular, they didn't fit the idea that we have in our minds of what a grieving mother may look like, weeping and distraught. These women showed little emotion, and it was hard to get our heads around because many of us just don't see that as normal, do we? I'm speaking very generally here, but most of us, I think, have such strong images in our mind about what a woman should look like or act, and that link between their demeanour and assumptions about somebody's credibility or guilt. Dr. Williams discusses a fascinating insight into the psychology that goes on in a trial. In fact, she sees a trial like a performance where two advocates stand up trying to persuade the jury to believe them and not the other. She spoke of something that I'd never thought of before, the fact that we can have a perception that just by a person sitting in a dock in a courtroom, it can persuade some people to think, well, if they're in the dock, they're guilty. Or, well, if they're in the dock, they're obviously too dangerous to let out of the dock. And surprisingly, you may be very surprised to know that we talk about podcasts. Who would have thought? And the role that they can play in a crime, both the positives and the negatives. And I'm pretty sure you'll be interested about her thoughts on the teacher's pet, because one of her views is that she talks about how that podcast came perilously close to being so prejudicial that it nearly caused the trial not to proceed. It's fascinating stuff. Have a great week, and we'll talk again next week. See ya. The article that I referred to in my introduction in The Guardian, which you contributed to, it covered the way that the legal system moulded Kathleen Folbig into how she should look in general, how she should look when she's grieving, what she should have or not written or not written in her diaries, and how she should conduct herself as a mother. Kathleen Folbig, she didn't fit the mould, did she, of a grieving mother. Can you tell us your thoughts and or findings on that?
Yeah, so the Folbig case is a really interesting case because it's the kind of case that is great fodder for the media. This was a quite shocking case. If you hear a headline of a woman being charged with the murder of four of her children or when they were babies, it sounds horrific. And then we see Kathleen Folbig going through her trial and see extracts from her diaries and hear the prosecution case about what they're alleging she did. And it is the kind of case that people have an emotional reaction to. All crime stories, to a degree, evoke a reaction in people, and that's why true crime is so popular. It's why the media cover crime news so extensively, because it is the kind of topic that gets a reaction out of people. But the Folbig case was really extraordinary in the circumstances that led to it being so newsworthy and something that the public was so interested in. In terms of the way Folbig was represented, so here I'm talking mostly about some findings that an honors student of mine who wrote all about the Folbig case and her representation during her trial and in the judicial inquiries too. So shout out to Becky Dunkel. She looked at the way in which the media discussed, or I suppose represented, Folbig throughout the different phases of her case, so throughout the trial and then throughout the judicial inquiries and eventually into her pardon. And what she found, which aligns with previous literature about the representation of women, particularly women who kill and particularly women who kill their children, is that Folbig's identity as a mother was really front and center, and her behavior was contrasted against what we might call ideal femininity, which is a characterization that expects women to be subordinate. It expects them to be nurturing. It expects them to be maternal and calm.
Emotional.
Yes, absolutely. Conservative, chaste, demure, all of these kind of words that I don't think anybody could ever conform to, but which is a standard that is held up for women who come into contact with the criminal justice system. And if you're a woman who has been accused of killing her own children, you can see how far away from that expectation of ideal femininity that you sit, especially if you are a woman who sits in court and isn't weeping for your children, isn't appearing to be in the emotional state that we might expect someone to be in. And that's an expectation that's impossible to meet, because we don't really know how we should expect someone who's accused of killing their children to behave. But there's, I suppose, an expectation that you look sad, or you look contrite, or you look in some way like you're having an emotional reaction, despite the fact that Folbig was being tried years after the death of her final child, more than a decade after the death of her first child. So it's not like she's having the reaction that she would have immediately upon the death of her child. She's in a totally different context, but we expect that emotional reaction as though the crime had just occurred.
I can only, what's the word? As a detective with sex offences, I can relate to that in a way, because there are victims of sexual assault that react the way that the public would expect them to. Some of them are just beside themselves with trauma, with grief, with they are so affected by the crime that they almost can't string two words together. They can't, nothing is in order. You know, as a detective, sometimes when they are that distressed, we are the ones that have to try and get the timeline sorted, because they can't. They don't remember things that you expect them, that we would expect people to remember. And sometimes they just concentrate on, I don't know, say the T-shirt the person was wearing. They'll be able to tell us everything about that T-shirt, what it said, what colour it was, the fact that it was frayed around the edge, all this sort of stuff. But then there are those victims of a sexual assault where they remember everything. They are so together. They don't appear on the outside to be grief-stricken, trauma. They are just so together with how, and they remember everything. So I get what you mean, that the public expect a certain behaviour, don't they, from how people react to different circumstances, and we all react differently.
Absolutely. And this holding up of women against ideal femininity, as you say, it doesn't just apply to women who are accused of crimes, but also to women who are victims of crime. This is why we see women who take complaints of sexual assault to the police and follow through with those and end up in court. We see these women experience an extraordinary amount of trauma in not only having to go through the criminal process and relive their experience and be cross-examined and have to face their perpetrator in court, but also if it's a high-profile case and the matter is being reported on, then their demeanour and the way that they appear to be responding and whether they're being emotional enough, or all of those things and also are used to, in a way, represent or have inferences drawn about their credibility, about whether they are a real victim or not. And that just adds another level of trauma to what they're already going through.
And you bring up a good point before about Lindy Chamberlain, for instance, like the way that the court, and I know I said this in my introduction, but the way that the court, the media, well, probably the court as well, but how they viewed Lindy Chamberlain, she was exactly what you're saying, I think, in relation to Kathleen Folbig. She wasn't feminine enough. She wasn't distressed enough. Yes. She was very, the word be, very controlled.
Yes.
And she wasn't hysterical or crying or showing any emotion. Mm. And boy, did she get criticised for that.
Absolutely. And that reaction can be a completely normal reaction to going through the trauma of losing a child. You might dissociate, you might have to control yourself to that degree to make it possible for you to get through that experience. But from the outside, people look at somebody who's behaving in that way and think, well, they can't possibly be, they're not upset at all. Look at them. They're not crying. They're not shaking. Their voice isn't breaking. They mustn't be sad about this at all. So therefore they must be guilty. So there's this link between somebody's demeanor, and women, I think, experience this much more than men do, this link between their demeanor and assumptions about somebody's credibility or guilt, because we have such a strong image of what a woman should look like and how a woman should act, even though that image doesn't necessarily line up with what we know from psychology is natural and is within the range of natural responses that somebody might have to a traumatic event.
Yeah, it's fascinating, the whole psychology behind how victims, even suspects, offenders, how they all react is just, it's incredibly interesting, I find. Like, to get into the mind, let's say, of an offender and get them to talk about how they feel about certain things and why they did certain things at a certain time, the history, you know, of their background. I just find the psychology in the whole criminal process fascinating.
I mean, there's even
I could talk about it forever.
There's even psychology in the trial, though. The criminal trial is a performance. It's two advocates standing up trying to persuade a jury that their case is the more persuasive one, even though rhetorically the prosecution is supposed to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. In reality, the criminal trial is a performance. You have characters who are there in costumes, you know, they're in wigs and robes. There's an audience, which is the jury. There's a certain script that is followed to a degree. You know, we have the opening addresses, and then we have the prosecution case. We have examination in chief followed by cross-examination. There's certain language that is used within the trial that is not used outside of the trial. It is really a performance, and part of that performance, part of the skill of an advocate, is playing to that performance and playing to the psychology and in a way drawing on the kind of stories and narratives and tropes that people will recognize in order to make their case more persuasive.
It's really a lot, and what you're saying is it's really a lot about the way somebody perceives you. Even the way you dress can be, you know, you can like the way somebody's dressed. It's a nice, like, let's for instance say a lawyer. Oh, yes, that's a really nice suit. Or, oh, they look like they've had a pretty rough night. We can be so critical, and we make up our mind pretty quickly, don't you think, about if we like somebody, the way they present their case to the jury, let's say. Sometimes, you know, you can sort of think, who is this person? Who do they think they are? They've got no idea. And then there's others who show such emotion, but you've got to be, obviously there's a level, you've got to be very careful. But, yeah, it's about first impressions, I suppose, all the time.
Absolutely. And even though we know that demeanour is an unreliable basis for judging somebody's credibility, whether it's a witness or if it's an accused person judging their guilt, it's human nature. We can't stop ourselves from seeing someone and making judgments about them, or from making judgments about, as you say, the way they dress or the way they speak, the way they hold themselves, answer questions, behave, whatever it might be. We know that that is unreliable, but it's something that is just so inherent in us that we can't stop ourselves from doing it.
Yeah, I know a couple of times we've had, somebody come into court, an offender who's been inside, he's been on remand, and when I caught him, let's say it's a rapist, you know, and he's got the shorts on and a singlet and he looks really dishevelled, and when he comes into court and he's got the suit and tie on and all nicely coiffed, you know, his hair's done and everything, you can think to yourself, my God, is that the same man? Like, you can be so influenced just by somebody's look.
Absolutely. And this kind of goes to part of the debate about whether we should retain the doc in courtrooms, because there's some evidence to say that the mere fact that an accused person is sitting in a dock, even if in New South Wales they're not sitting in the dock in prison gear wearing handcuffs, but nonetheless they're sitting in a dock, does that create the perception, or does that encourage a perception among the jurors or people who are observing the case, a perception of their guilt or of their deviance, because, oh, look, they need to be kept in a box, they must be dangerous, they must be guilty. So there's some argument to say that we should do away with docs in courtrooms to minimise that unconscious bias that the defendant experiences by virtue of being locked in a box.
You know, I have never heard of that, but that makes a whole lot of sense to me, because you're right, somebody in a dock, you think, oh, that's the guilty man or that's the guilty woman, you know, but, oh, they've done it. Absolutely. I've never thought of that before. Do you have, is that making any leeway in New South Wales, or is that just something that's being talked about at the moment?
It's more of a debate in academic circles than in reality, I would say. It would be, I would suggest, a brave politician who would suggest that we remove docs from courtrooms. Generally, it's about building courtrooms with, you know, stronger docs and bigger docs and more sophisticated docs. But it's certainly, there's academic research out there to say that when we ask people's perceptions about the guilt of a person, the way that they're dressed, where they're situated in a courtroom, has an impact on their perception of the person's guilt. And if we were to adopt the practice in the US where the defendant sits at the bar table next to their lawyer, that is the least prejudicial position for them to take in the courtroom because they look like they're a party to the proceedings rather than a dangerous person locked in a box off to the side.
And that's true, but also you've got to be able to make sure that the court is safe. And there are some people that you could never allow to, you know, sit next to other people without, let's say, being handcuffed or without having security guards both sides of them. There are just some people.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You know, it's about the safety of the community, whether they be outside the box or inside the box. You know, they're interesting discussions. God.
And, I mean, those concerns can arise, as you say, with somebody in the box. A lot of courtrooms in New South Wales, it's just an open dock. It's a kind of waist, or not even waist high, maybe hip-high fence. Easy enough for a person, if they want to jump out of it, to jump out of it. And that has certainly occurred relatively rarely, but that's why we have court officers in the courtroom, in order to make sure that if something does go awry, there's someone there to make sure that everyone's safe.
And I suppose just going back to Kathleen Folbig and Lindy Chamberlain and how, let's say, the legal system moulded her, but the media did as well, and I'm pretty sure we covered this, but the media have a lot of power, and some would say too much power. And I've thought before that they don't seem to be all that accountable to anyone or to many in the way that they report a crime. I suppose they can be so influential, and sometimes that influence can be really subtle.
Yes.
Do you think that the journalists or the media need an overriding body to assure, I suppose they have got one, I'm not sure what it is, but to assure us, the community, that they are reporting the facts rather than their opinions?
So I agree that the media has a lot of power, and that's sometimes the way that they report on matters. The subtlety with which they report can make a difference about how we understand what it is that they're reporting. So my research was all about how newspapers in particular report on criminal trials. And one of the key findings I found was that even though what was being reported fell within the rules that we would expect of what journalists are allowed to report on from criminal trials, in many ways it was the way that they reported on it. And it was something that wouldn't be able to be addressed by the powers that judges have to regulate what it is that journalists can report on. Because it wasn't what they were saying, but how they were saying it, implicit ways that they were bringing in comparisons to, say, ideal femininity or for men, the kind of ideal version of whatever that man's role was in society. So the ideal father or the ideal police officer or whatever it might be. So kind of without saying it explicitly, highlighting the deviance of the defendant before they had been convicted, and really providing a very clear, but very subtle indication that this was the bad person, despite the fact that we've not yet had a legal determination of their guilt, we've very clearly set them as a kind of social deviant, someone who's breached societal norms about what we would expect of a person of that gender or a person in that particular role. In terms of how we can hold the media to account on that, I don't know that a body other than what already exists to manage complaints about the press would be more effective than what we have now because of that subtlety. It can really be a matter for interpretation, because the media could say, oh, that's just your slant, that's just how you're reading it. If you actually look at the content, it really is just the facts. There are remedies if a media organisation does blatantly report something that they shouldn't or that is inaccurate or whatever it might be. And those are often remedies from the court. So it could be a fine, it could be a charge of contempt. So there are some remedies in place. And as I said, the media, the mainstream media in Australia is quite good at self-regulation generally because of that. Because it's about trust, right? They want people to be able to trust what they're saying. And most of the time they try and uphold or try and build that trust by showing that they're being serious about what it is that they're reporting on. But when they do get it wrong, when they do report on something that is inaccurate, I think there's potential for that to either be corrected by people having exposure to a number of different media sources. So if you're seeing that one media source is reporting something and the others are not, or the others are reporting it differently, that might help readers or consumers of that media to maybe be a little bit more critical about what it is they're reading and think, you know, is this true, or has, you know, this one organisation gone too far? Has this one journalist kind of gone off track a bit? So I think having consumers be critical about what they're reading, what they're consuming, what it is that they want from their media is probably the most effective thing that we can do to make the media, I suppose, more careful or more considerate of what they're reporting, because they're reporting to get in front of the eyeballs of consumers. And if consumers don't trust them, they won't consume their content.
Yeah. I wanted to talk, surprisingly, a little bit about podcasts.
I wonder why.
Who would have thought? No, but I'd actually like to start talking, if we could, about the Teacher's Pet podcast. And I read in the Law Society Journal of November 2022 an article by Angela Tavesson, where you provided some opinions, and the article was called Probing the Legacy of the Teacher's Pet. You talked about how perilously close the podcast came to being so prejudicial as to prevent the trial ever proceeding, almost like derailing the carriage of justice, I suppose, and with it, the trust in the system itself. And I understood you were referring to the fact the podcast had reported Chris Dawson, the man convicted of his wife, Lynette Dawson's murder. He hadn't taken opportunities to provide his side of the story when that opportunity arose. And the fact that he'd chosen the right to remain silent in previous court proceedings, which is obviously his right. Mm. It's an interesting conundrum, isn't it? Because most people believe in an almost, with Chris Dawson, let's say, whatever it takes, that man is guilty, that sort of mindset.
Yes.
Can you expand a bit on that for us?
So the difficulties with the teacher's pet were that this was potentially, or this was the first real example of a podcast on a cold case that led to somebody actually being charged with that crime. And at the outset, I think it's important to say that that's a really important development and shows the strength of particularly new forms of media in holding the system to account, because without that podcast, we would probably never have seen Chris Dawson be held to account for the murder of his wife.
Hmm.
But the problem with the teacher's pet, or some of the concerns around the teacher's pet, were partly, and this was said by Justice Fullerton in her judgment, on the application that had been made to permanently stay the proceedings, which is what I meant by it came perilously close to really undermining the proceedings at all, because Dawson's team made this application for a permanent stay of proceedings based on the extraordinary degree of prejudicial publicity.
Yeah.
Justice Fullerton made a comment that said, this is the first time in this state that we have seen, I'm not going to get the quote right, but that we have essentially seen something of this magnitude, where not only was, even though the podcast was at pains to say, we're not saying Chris Dawson did it, it was inferred, you could infer as a listener that Chris Dawson was guilty or very probably guilty. And also the podcast involved the interviewing of people who would be key prosecution witnesses. And those people were then able to hear what other people had said, and it cast doubt on whether their evidence was their own evidence or was evidence that was contaminated by what they'd heard other people say. So that was one of the really big criticisms of the podcast in terms of the effect that it might have on the ability of a trial to go ahead, not just the fact that it had, created this perception of Chris Dawson as being guilty, but also that interaction with prosecution witnesses in a way that potentially made them really vulnerable to being considered unreliable witnesses when it did come to trial. That application for a permanent stay obviously was not successful, and the Dawson trial went ahead as a judge alone trial, which was the remedy that was said to overcome the prejudicial publicity that he had experienced prior to the trial. But we saw that argument about, association of his silence with his guilt come up again in relation to that trial, because apparently during the creation of the Teacher's Pet podcast, he had been invited to come onto the podcast, had chosen not to. Throughout the trial, Dawson did not give evidence, again, exercising his right to silence. But that was, again, represented as, if he's got nothing to hide, why wouldn't he say anything? And I think that this is where that contrast between legal understandings of justice and social understandings of justice really come into conflict, because there is that perception of, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear.
Mm.
But the right to silence and the presumption of innocence, we find it harder to accept those rights when they relate to unpopular defendants than when they relate to someone who is maybe not so high profile or not so unpopular or who hasn't committed what we might consider to be a really heinous offence. So I think it's in those cases with the really unpopular defendants where we see the need for those protections, because as you say, in some cases we think whatever it takes, but whatever it takes might mean that somebody who has committed a crime is maybe convicted of a more serious crime than the one that they actually committed, or somebody who didn't commit a crime but who just has the unfortunate or is in the unfortunate position of looking like they might have committed that crime ends up being sort of overrun, convicted of a crime and spending time in prison for a crime they didn't commit.
It's amazing, you know, because that right to silence is anybody and everybody's right. And you're right, because somebody chooses that, they can often be judged and sometimes, you know, often wrongly. But I don't know how many times I've had an offender be, you know, arrested and brought in to be interviewed, and the first thing their legal representative will say is make no comment, whether they've done it or not.
Yeah.
That, you know, and that's their right. But I do think that is anybody's right to say that. And I do wonder to myself, I wonder why Chris Dawson would actually say yes to, even if he hadn't been guilty, why would he say yes to, you know, some podcaster that wants to make a bit of a name? I'm not saying this about Hedley Thomas. I'm just saying, how does he know, Chris Dawson know, that this isn't a bloke that's going to say, oh, I won't ask you this, I won't ask you that, and then it all gets very awkward.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think, why would you?
If you were in his position, you would say no as well.
Of course I would. I don't know many people that would say yes, because anything you say, it can be twisted and turned, and we all know how often that happens with, you know, within a criminal process. You just have to answer something in the witness box the wrong way or the right, whatever, but you can say one word and they can spend days on what did you mean by that word, you know?
Absolutely. And that's why people are advised to make no comment to the police, or why people might choose not to give evidence in court, because if you give evidence, you're opening yourself up to cross-examination, and cross-examination is terrifying.
Tell me about it.
It's a really trying process. And most people who come into contact with the criminal justice system are people who experience some disadvantage or some vulnerability, whether that has to do with their socioeconomic background or maybe their educational background or mental health or cognitive impairment, whatever it might be. There's some level of disadvantage or vulnerability. I find the idea of cross-examination terrifying, and I understand the mechanics of it. You can see why someone who's vulnerable could be really easily influenced into behaving in a way or speaking in a way or making statements that are against their interests, even if those statements or the way that they behave doesn't necessarily reflect the reality of whether they're guilty or not. It's an extraordinarily trying process that I don't think many people would voluntarily put themselves up for.
Oh, no. And, you know, and also, you are being cross-examined, whether you're a witness as a police person, as an expert witness, it doesn't matter, a victim, but you are being cross-examined by somebody who has done this time and time again. They know, I'm going to sound wrong here, but they know how to get you into a position where you've said something and you just can't get out of it, and you get yourself into more trouble the more you say. They are experts at that. And I can understand why people do – well, I think most – I don't know anyone that actually enjoys cross-examination apart from the prosecutor and the lawyer and the defence lawyer, because you're right, it is a terrifying experience. And when I think about – you know, say a victim of any crime, but I always go back to sex offences because that's my experience. But to get them into a witness box and then be, well, what I call it being hammered by a defense lawyer, it is, I don't know too many that have, you know, you get people that stand up and say, you can't say that about me or whatever, but, and then you're told, you know, you say to them, calm down, you just answer the question, but no, it's more times than not, you're like a deer in the headlights.
and I think cross-examination can be really seen as akin to police interrogation because it's...
Of course it can,
The person has in their mind an idea of what they want you to say, and there's a range of strategies that they can use to get you to say that thing that they want you to say. And we have, in New South Wales, what I would say are relatively limited protections for witnesses during cross-examination. So we have a provision in the Evidence Act that allows the judge to step in if they think a witness is being questioned in a way that is unduly harassing, annoying.
I'd call that hammered.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're being very kind, but being
what
hammered.
What amounts to being unduly harassed or unduly annoyed is a subjective standard. And what the convention of cross-examination is that it is an uncomfortable process. It's a process that is inherently stressful and intimidating and annoying. And witnesses just have to put up with it, basically, even though they're at a significant disadvantage.
But also the defence lawyer, he's trying to get his client off. So the more you can look like you're confusing, I suppose, the person in the witness box, the more that the jury, start to think, oh, gee, I don't know if they're telling the truth or they seem a bit confused. If they're confused about this, they could have been confused about that. Yeah, it's a no-win in my view.
Yeah, and the same for prosecutors. That's the whole point of cross-examination, is to cast doubt on the reliability, the credibility of the evidence. Because even if the defence lawyer, their job isn't to get the defendant off necessarily, it's to make sure that if they have committed a crime, they're being convicted of the actual crime they committed rather than a more serious crime. Or they're there to make sure that the due process has been followed. And if the person is convicted, they've been convicted, from a fair trial, and that involves testing the evidence. So if they're asking witnesses questions and, they might be attempting to confuse the witness or attempting to highlight that the witness is confused about something or has made a contradictory statement or whatever it might be, that is part of the process of testing the strength of the prosecution case. And the prosecution does the same thing too when they cross-examine the defendant or if they cross-examine any of the defence witnesses.
I was going to say they don't get much of a chance to cross-examine a defendant because very rarely they take the stand.
Yes, and that's the reason why defendants are often advised not to, because cross-examination is such a harrowing process and such a process that can be so detrimental to the interests of the defendant as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, we could talk about giving evidence for days. Actually, have you given much evidence in court with your expertise?
I have not, no, and I'm very glad to have not been cross-examined.
Oh, anybody out there that needs an expert, I'm going to put you right in here. And then I'm going to come along and I'm going to listen to you give evidence.
But I suppose you've given a lot of evidence in your time as a police officer.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I have. And it's harrowing every time. I think it's like these days, a lot of the police that join, it might take them 5 years before they actually have to get up in court and give evidence, which I think is a shame, because I do think giving evidence makes you tick every box, cross every T, what is it? Cross every T, dot every I, just so that you know your evidence so well. I think I have given evidence too many, not hundreds of times, but certainly a lot. A trial is a whole new ball game. Seeing that that jury there, you think, you know what, this is the real deal.
Oh my God, absolutely.
I hope I say the right thing and I don't muck it up for everyone.
There's such a level of responsibility that witnesses feel too, no matter what you know, no matter who the witness is, no matter what party they're there for, the level of responsibility that a witness feels to, you know, answer the questions properly or to convince the jury or to, you know, do their best, it's a really stressful experience.
Yeah. Actually, I'm quite surprised that you've never been required to give evidence, because I would have thought your area of expertise may have required some, insight from an expert.
I suppose it depends on the matter, right? My area of expertise is really something that would be more related, I suppose, to pre-trial issues. And in terms of having somebody come in to give evidence, you know, say you've got a sexual assault case and the prosecutor is a little bit worried that the complainant is not presenting in a way that might be sympathetic to the jury, the prosecution might call in an expert witness to give evidence about the different ways that people react to sexual assault and react to trauma in general. The expert they would call in for that would be a psychologist. Someone like me. Yeah.
Next week is the final part of my interviews with Dr. Leah Williams. Next week, we discuss a fair bit about the positives and negatives of podcasts, how the justice system manages social media, and a juror's temptation to do some of their own research. We also talk about, in the media world, what is their ideal victim, or what is their idea of an ideal victim, an ideal offender, and what happens when someone doesn't fit that description. And we're treated to Dr. Williams' thoughts about New South Wales former policeman come murderer, Roger Rogerson, as his case was one of those case studies she did in her PhD research, and how the media were restricted in how they could describe him during his trials. For instance, the words disgraced or notorious were banned due to possible prejudice. So have a great week, and we'll chat next week. See you later. As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.